Doom do 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 do. Hiya, plant friends. Welcome to episode 79 of
Bloom and Grow Radio.
My plant friends, hello, hello, hello. How you doing? I hope your weeks have been wonderfully planty. As per usual, I'm so excited to bring you another fabulous episode with the OG botanical bro of Bloom and Grow Radio, Chris Satch. This week, we are talking about variegation 101. So what the heck variegation actually is? How does it happen? How can we foster it? Can we foster it? The conversation is awesome. It's so good, I'm not going to tell you any more about it, but I do have a few announcements. The number one thing being, so the rest of this season is going to move to episodes every other week. And this is because my rehearsal schedule with Cats, the tour, has become really crazy. It's been a lot busier than anticipated. And in order to protect the integrity of the show, the quality of the episodes that I'm bringing to you, and also my mental stability, because I am doing 8 shows a week with Cats, including all of these rehearsals, we just need to scale back the episodes that we're releasing, but they're still really awesome, like today's episode on Variegation 101. So you can expect episodes every other Tuesday for the remainder of 2019. Plant friends, this has not been a decision that I've come to lightly. It has kind of pained me to have to do this because I just want to keep bringing you weekly episodes, but I really needed to get quiet and think about the integrity of the show and the quality of the episodes. And like I said, my ability to not completely burn out in this season of my life. So that being said, plant friends, this is episode 79 of Bloom and Grow Radio. And I have a feeling a lot of you probably haven't listened to the OG episodes. I know I have a lot of OG listeners and I'm very thankful for you, but I can't recommend enough the first 20 episodes of Bloom and Grow Radio. Man, we have some amazing guests and some amazing conversations. If you haven't listened to Your Brain on Plants, where I interview a neurologist about what happens in our brains when we get addicted to plants, that's a little bit of a scroll down. Like, scroll down the feed and see what other episodes you haven't listened to, because I bet there is an episode that I have already made for you that you have not listened to, or maybe you have and you need to go back and visit. So I will always be with you, plant friends, and I will still be on Instagram, and ideally, hopefully, I will still be releasing a couple of YouTube videos for you. I know I've had some requests for a tour of my apartment with Billy and some requests for a tour of my grow light, so I'm going to try my hardest to get those together for you in the midst of my crazy schedule. So thanks for flowing and blooming and growing with me as this schedule blooms and grows as well. And I'm excited. 2020, I think, will bring a little bit more stability in that area. Patreon plant friends, there's so many new ones of you. Thank you so much for joining our community and helping me make these shows. And it's starting to truly take a village. I'm so thankful for my editor, Aaron. You guys are completely supporting him and more. So thank you for our new Patreon supporters, Joni James, Christine McKinley, Dylan Blundun, and Jane M. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for becoming part of our community. I am so thankful for all of you. And we have hit our 100 Patreon mark, which means I am going to, in the next couple of months, get my act together and survey you guys and see what you would want for higher levels of Patreon and how I could better serve you guys individually, because you guys are what keeps it going. You're what keep me showing up to my microphone every week. So thank you. I'm so excited to bring you this episode with Chris. He has asked me to tell you guys that he's so excited. He's heavily involved with the Manhattan Orchid Society, and they are currently in the final pushes of putting together their annual orchid show, which is going to be very special in January. And he asked me to do a call to action to you guys. If you are interested in potentially volunteering at the show that is going to be in New York in January, or if you could possibly donate, the link to the Manhattan Orchid Society is going to be in the show notes. It's going to bring you to the event webpage and check it out. And if you're into orchids and if you're into supporting Chris, you should definitely go check it out and see how you can help and have some planty fun. So Chris is one of the OG botanical bros, one of our OG guests. He was on episode, I think, 2 or 3 of the show. That was our first episode together. And I'm so excited to also have one of the OG sponsors of Bloom and Grow Radio, Modern Sprout, as today's supporter. Thank you, Modern Sprout, for supporting today's episode. Plant friends, Modern Sprout offers simple, stylish, and sustainable green thumb solutions for every home, no matter what style or what level of green thumb you are at. So if you have been an OG listener of Bloom and Grow Radio, or if you've been following me on Instagram for a while, you will know about Modern Sprout because I have several of their grow lights and their planter kits in my apartment. I've had them for years now. And I'm so excited because Modern Sprout has recently launched an entire line of new products and expanded the lines that they already have just in time for the gift-giving season. Because plant friends, it is upon us. It is November. Gift-giving season is here. And if you are looking for planty gifts for whoever you have in your life, whether they're the highest level green thumb or whether they're a plant killer, Modern Sprout has an option for you. So I have had their Grow Bar, which is their bar of grow lights that you can install anywhere. I installed it in my bookshelf, and their grow house, which is a gorgeous glass container that's almost like a terrarium with a grow light in it. I have had both of those grow lights installed in my apartment for a year. And I love how Modern Sprout has these innovative solutions to bring high light environments to your low light, smaller areas of your apartment. Modern Sprout has recently launched an entire new and improved line of grow lights called their Grow Frames. So plant friends, their Grow Frames are wall-mountable frames that have grow lights inside of them. So you can actually take your plant collections and build them up your wall. They're so cool, so modern, so sleek. They come in three different sizes, and the actual lights in the grow frames are actually twice as powerful as their last line of lights because Modern Sprout is always improving themselves. These grow frames are so versatile, whether you want to mount them on the wall, whether you want to maybe sit them on a counter or a desk. I actually just recently sent a grow frame to my friend Kate. When I saw her cubicle that didn't have any plants in it, I sent her a grow frame, which is sitting in her cubicle at work, and it's so cute. I can't say enough wonderful things about their grow lights. I adore them. They have a three-setting timer, so you set it and you forget it. The installation is super easy. They come with everything you need for installing. Modern Sprout also is known for their incredibly wide array of self-watering planters. So we all learned about passive hydroponics a couple weeks ago on Bloom and Grow Radio, and all of their planters are passive hydroponic setups. So they have so many different kits in a variety of styles that would fit into any type of household. So they have their rustic mason jars, they have more bohemian terracotta styles, they also have super sexy, sleek, modern tapered tumblers, and in those different styles of tumblers, you can grow a variety of seed types that come with each kit. So you can do kitchen herbs, cocktail herbs, you could do medicinal or aromatic plants like lavender or chamomile, which are so nice. You can now grow your own succulents or cacti like aloe or prickly pear. And my favorite these days is you can actually grow flowers. So you could have poppies or daisies blooming and growing in your home at any time of the year, so long as you have the light. These grow lights and these grow kits would make the perfect holiday gift, plant friends, for really anyone in your life. It could be a loved one, maybe a teacher, a hostess gift, or maybe just yourself. Maybe you put one of those grow frames on your wish list, if you know what I'm saying. So, if you are interested in checking out their grow lights or their grow kits, Modern Sprout is offering Bloom and Grow listeners 15% off your next purchase with code BLOOM15 at checkout. So head on over to modernsprout.com, check out their amazing grow light options, grow kit options, and they have great accessories too, like really awesome little snippers for your plants, and use code BLOOM15 at checkout for 15% off. Okay, here's Chris. Chris, my favorite botanical bro, welcome back to the show.
Hey.
I'm so thankful to have you back. We've done so many episodes together now. It's like you're like a long-term partner of Bloom and Grow Radio.
Yes.
I love it.
Yeah.
So I'm so excited to have you back on the show today to talk about variegation because it's been something that I've been getting increasingly curious about because, number one, all these variegated plants, or you see these variegated plants are the ones that are going on eBay for like thousands of dollars. So we're, as consumers, like investing our dollars into these variegated plants. And then you hear those horrible stories about people spending so much money on a variegated plant and getting it home and then it dying because all the white leaves like turn brown. Or also personally, like I'm just so curious to what's going on and why it's happening. And if it's a good or a bad thing, and if it's a bad thing, like why as plant parents we want it so much. So I'm excited to just kind of uncover all of it with you today.
Absolutely. No, I mean, variegation is something that we plant nerds kind of like talk about a lot because it actually is a pretty interesting phenomenon. It's not particularly well studied in the sciences. The scientific community is more focused on like increasing plant production, trying to feed the world, things like that. So variegation kind of takes a backseat. There is some research on variegation, some university research on it, but it's more so in terms of genetics. Like we use variegation as a way to help understand genetics of plants because one of the many causes of variegation is genetics. So it's not very well studied, but to understand variegation, we have to understand the way in which variegation happens. So
yeah, what is it?
There's different kinds of variegation. So I can't even say it's this one thing. It's actually a couple of things. And one of the things that variegation is the improper formation of a chloroplast. So you lose that pigmentation or creation of pigmentation. You know, a plant is hyperpigmented somewhere. There's different forms of it. So to really understand variegation, I'm going to dive into a little bit about a leaf anatomy to sort of give everyone a better idea of what's happening. So,
okay, hold on one sec. Before we do leaf anatomy, so overarching variegation is just when a plant's leaf isn't necessarily green, right? Like when there is a color variation in either the leaf or the flower.
Exactly. So, and that color variation can happen in different ways. It could pigment the whole leaf. It could be a specific pattern on a leaf, or it could be completely random on a leaf, like marbling.
Okay. And you're saying that this variegation goes down to a chloroplast, which is part of a cell of the plant, right? Chloroplasts are part of what makes the plant green.
Yeah. But usually though, it's not always the chloroplast in all cases. So,
okay, but it goes down to a cellular level with the plant.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. So variegated plants are plants that are kind of not just green, have some color incorporated into their leaf, kind of a mutation. So, okay, so talk to me about leaf anatomy now.
So understanding variegation, you have to kind of understand that the plant actually has three sets of DNA, so to speak, or three, I guess you could call them genomes in a way. The plant has what we call its nuclear genome, which is the plant's DNA itself. This is the plant's DNA. It belongs to the plant. It is the core of the plant. So there's the nuclear DNA. Then there's the plastid DNA. So what are plastids? Plastids are little tiny organelles that are inside of a cell, kind of like my organ does something for my whole body. An organelle in the cell does something for the cell. So just like my liver detoxifies me, plastids do all kinds of stuff like that. So plastids are responsible for capturing and harvesting light. That would be a chloroplast. A mitochondria is another type of plastid too. That has its own DNA as well. That's responsible for being like the stomach or the powerhouse of the cell, breaking down energy. And then there's other things like chromoplasts, which are just specifically for pigmentation. Plants make different kinds of pigments with chromoplasts, and there's other different kinds of plastids as well. And each kind of plastid has its own set of DNA and actually behaves independently inside the cell. So it's literally like cells living inside cells, which is pretty cool. And so they came about actually, which I think this story is maybe worth mentioning. There's this theory right now. It's called the endosymbiotic theory. And that theory goes is that it tries to explain why chloroplasts and mitochondria have completely different sets of DNA than the organisms that they're inside, or why they even have their own sets of DNA. And scientists currently believe that it's because way, 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 way long ago, ancient millions, billions of years ago, when life was mostly single-celled organisms, the ancestor of everything that is to become multicellular, or at least eukaryotic, I'll throw a term around, eukaryotic, ingested or tried to ingest a mitochondrion as a free-living bacteria, which it was at the time, or free-living, you know, single-celled organism, couldn't digest it. And instead, the mitochondria started living inside of that cell and reproducing inside of that cell. And they started working together until eventually, millions and millions and millions of years later, the mitochondria has actually given some of its genes to the nuclear genome, and the nuclear genome has actually given some of its genes to the mitochondria. So now they're codependent. Same thing for the chloroplast. So chloroplast was a second engulfing event. You know, this cell with the mitochondrion already engulfed a photosynthetic bacteria or photosynthetic single-celled organism and just kind of absorbed it. Whether or not these are bacteria, I'm not quite sure. I don't remember, but it was a single-celled organism. That much I do remember. And eventually they start working together over time. So the plastids then became more responsible for pigmentation. So the nuclear genome, the plant itself, that can make proteins which synthesize pigments for the plant. The chloroplasts and the plastids and the chromoplasts can also make pigments for the plant. So I'm going to stop right there. So far with me?
Yes, I love that this like episode on variegation is like the history of the cell, like the history of life. Yeah. But yes, yeah, so there's two different sets of genes, well, three, but the nuclear and the plastid, and they can both make what color the plant, pigments that color the plant separately.
Yes, absolutely. Or lack thereof. Yeah. For example, in like variegated Monstera, where the variegation is either like a gold color or a cream color or white, in that case, it would be a loss of pigmentation. And in other cases, it would be hyperpigmentation. Like, for example, in oxalis, it would be like, oh, normal oxalis is green, but this oxalis is now purple. So you have different kinds of variegation.
Okay, so variegation is either loss of pigmentation or hyperpigmentation. Okay, cool.
So now let's talk about the different ways in which it occurs structurally. So variegation can occur, and the most common kind of variegation, or one of the more common kinds, I should say, is more of what they call tissue variegation or chimeral variegation. It's where you have two different kinds of tissue, and this is controlled by the nuclear genome of the plant. This is controlled purely by the plant itself. And so when I say tissue or chimeral, chimera means you're taking two different things and morphing them together. And that's kind of actually more accurate, because what's happening here is if you have a plant like, let's say, an aluminum pilea, Pilea cattieri, or a begonia or a jewel orchid, those have what you see as like metallic sheens. Have you ever seen the metallic sheen in those?
Oh, yeah. They're so beautiful. I love that aluminum pilea. I mean, peperomia. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like sparkling. They're all great. And so that's actually caused by two different types of tissues being grown by the plant itself. So you have one type of pigmented tissue and another type of pigmented tissue sort of playing with the light. And so the purpose of that is, or why would plants even want to be metallic? So you think about that, you take a step back, you're like, wait, I thought plants were supposed to be gathering and absorbing light because light is their food, right? Why would a plant want to be sparkly and throw away that light? Because a sparkle is essentially you're reflecting the light. So the reason we think why plants would want to be metallic is because the specifically low light plants tend to be, you know, more metallic-y, because we think that it's a way for them to take advantage of the low light that they're given in the forest and to actually focus the light, like a bunch of mirrors focusing the light onto one point and focusing that light onto their chloroplast. So the current theory is that the reason why plants are metallic, or a lot of like lower light plants are metallic, is because they want to absorb as much light as they can and focus it on a chloroplast. And then as it passes through, whatever goes out, goes out.
So by becoming silver, the light is focusing because it's almost reflecting off of it. And so that helps them absorb the light for photosynthesis better?
Right. It helps them to focus the light on their chloroplast so that they can gather what little exists and then focus it, kind of like taking like a magnifying glass and just kind of like really trying to make the best out of it that you can.
Fun fact, you know, that's interesting, because I think of variegation as like a variegated Monstera where it's green and white, you know, or a variegated, I don't know, Syngonium. I feel like I've seen a lot of those like on Instagram lately, where it's like green and white, or maybe some pink, but I didn't even think about a plant like that aluminum plant being variegated. I just think about it being like two-tone, but really any two-tone is a form of variegation, I guess.
Right. I personally am trying to pioneer the difference between variegation and coloration, which is what I'm eventually getting to, is that they're all forms of variegation. Variegation is just kind of like non-wild type coloration of some sort. So metallic sheen is one of them. Coloration of leaves, like for example, if there's like a purple variety of something, like for example, and I know this was bred into it, but like ZZ Black Raven, the ZZ plant, Zamia Colchis Black Raven.
Oh, hashtag so hot right now.
Oh, yeah. And that is a hyperpigmented ZZ plant, but that's full coloration. So that's like another kind of variegation, except they happen to like breed that one into it. And you can breed variegation in sometimes like that. So there's metallic sheen, which I actually personally like. I'm actually ordering a metallic begonia right now, Begonia pavonina. because it's just awesome. And I secretly love begonias, and two, it's just metallic and awesome. Why would you not want it?
I think those metallic looking like plants are so freaking cool.
Oh yeah.
So you were saying, so tissue variegation is two different kinds of pigment showing up in a leaf, which tends to be metallic. And then is the next type of variegation the coloration of leaves that you just mentioned?
Right. That would be like pigmentary variegation. So
like a hyperpigmented ZZ plant or a purple oxalis.
Exactly. Exactly. It's where you have just overproduction of some kind of pigments, whether they're anthocyanins, which make like the pinks purples, but like a very specific kind of pink purple. It's like, it's weird. Once you have an eye for it, you'll know, oh, this is anthocyanin produced versus this is carotenoid produced, or this is these other class of pigments produced. So typically anthocyanins are like the light pink, like the Barbie doll pinks, and like the Barbie doll, like light purples, and then like violets as well. But they can be other colors too. Carotenoids tend to be like your hard reds, yellows, oranges, things like that. And they can work together to form like other colors. It's never just one or the other being produced. There's like an entire cocktail of pigments being produced to make whatever color the plant is. But even with pigmentation, it can be whole leaf or it can be zonal. Like for example, in bromeliads, you'll notice that at the core of, let's say, Guzmania bromeliads, which I think are the most commonly sold bromeliads, those are those kind of like
bird's nesty looking. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, this thing's everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you have that, and like the center is like red, but the outer parts of the leaves are like green. That would be more of like a zonal pigmentation. So that's a kind of variegation.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So I'm realizing that variegation is more present than I thought. I feel like I think of variegated as like the super rare plants, but variegated is really any plant that's not just all green.
Right. Exactly. And I think that like a lot of marketers or things like that kind of toss that term around because inherently variegation, as we think of it, like the marbling kind of variegation, that's actually kind of rare-ish depending on what plant you're talking about. Different kinds of variegations are actually rare, which is why they're like, oh, this is variegated, you want it. But I feel like, you know, sometimes it's like misused a little bit just to drive up to make sales. So do be careful.
Interesting. Okay, cool. So we have tissue variegation, we have coloration of leaves, and then did you say there was one other type?
There's two other types-ish, actually. The first one I'll say is, I'll call it pathological variegation, where you can get variegation from either phytoplasmas, fungi, viruses, and things like that, bacteria too. So one thing that people should know is that plants play with their genetics all the time. And in nature, plants kind of GMO themselves all the time with like bacteria and fungi in nature, which I think is super cool and super awesome that they're just kind of like in nature GMOing themselves. They actually trade genetic information with bacteria that live on them, with fungi that live on and inside them. Those fungi that live inside of them are called endophytes. A lot of times they're actually very beneficial for the plant to have inside. Kind of like I have gut bacteria inside me. Plants have like their equivalent of gut bacteria too. So like I said, oh, there's fungi inside them. It sounded scary for a second, but there's actually a lot of good fungi, you know, that really help them out there. So anyway, pathological causes of variegation are, and usually viruses and phytoplasmas are the main culprits here. It's when they infect a plant and they create what are called transposons. And transposons are, the layman's term would be jumping genes. They're genes that just jump to other parts of the genome. And so the location of a gene in the genome, kind of like the location of a book in a library, is sort of important. Like you'll still have the book there, it'll still be read, but it might be harder to find or it might not show up at all if it's moved. Like people might not be able to find it. This is kind of similar with like a transposon. So transposons are jumping genes. If perchance, let's say there is a gene for, let's say, red pigmentation, and the virus cuts that DNA in half and rips it and pops half of it somewhere else, that gene can no longer be read. It's kind of like taking a magazine, ripping it in half and hiding one half of it. That deactivates the gene, so it no longer make that pigment. So you have a loss of pigment. And so a lot of viruses cause what's called mottling, or like a lot of them are called mosaic viruses because they cause that mosaic pattern of just random losses of pigment because of these transposons that they generate to like kind of really shuffle the DNA around. So usually these pathological causes of variegation are shunned and harm the plant and aren't good at all. Although sometimes they're actually like the plant can live with them and they can be stabilized and they can sort of live in this weird harmony. Typically white pines and hostas are like that. So in white pine, this is like a little off variegation, but they get infected with a phytoplasma, which causes what's called a witch's broom, which actually we use for hedges. So those like really like compact piney hedges that are like kind of vomited everywhere across American landscapes. Those are actually, most of them or a lot of them are what's called a witch's broom of a white pine. So white pine is like this huge tree. A witch's broom is just like one where all the buds start growing out of control. None of the buds are suppressed. So you get this really compact, really piney looking thing. And that's just one example of what a phytoplasma can do. With hostas, you can get colorful variegation, colorful patterns, random patterns in hostas from hosta mosaic virus. And sometimes those are propagated because the virus isn't lethal to the plant and the plant can still grow and reproduce and be happy. But you do want to be careful with virally induced variegation because to one kind of plant, it may be okay and live with it, but to other plants, that virus may be deadly. So for example, my orchids or even my variegated ZZ plant, and I collect all kinds of variegation personally. I have a variegated ZZ plant and I have different variegated orchids. Like I have a variegated maxillaria and I keep it separate, like I keep its watering tray separate from everybody else. I kind of keep it a little off to the side from everybody else because in the event that it is virally induced, I don't want to spread that virus for better or for worse.
That was actually a question one of our plant friends had, Shanna. She said, when I'm plant shopping, how can I tell the difference between variegation, nutrient deficiency, and mosaic virus? How do I make sure I'm making the right purchase, because is it good to even buy a plant with mosaic virus? So what would your answer be?
My answer would be generally no, it's not great to buy a plant with mosaic virus. And the thing about viruses is that plants can have viruses and be asymptomatic, meaning they show no symptoms. So you could have a perfectly green, happy, healthy plant and it could have all these viruses, you just don't know it. So there's no real way to tell if it has a virus or not. It's just kind of like a rule that like, oh, if it's randomly variegated in a plant that normally is not variegated, could be a virus.
So if you see like a fiddleleaf fig, like we don't see a lot of variegated fiddleleaf figs. So if you see a fiddleleaf fig with random marbling on its leaves, that's probably a mosaic virus or probably a bad form of variegation, like something you wouldn't want to bring home.
Well, it could be virus or it could be just a random mutation in the chloroplast. So if the chloroplasts mutate, which can happen randomly, and that's the thing, you don't know. You don't know if it's a virus. You don't know if it's like a random, like, okay mutation. So it could be good. It could be bad. You can shy away if you want to, but I mean, I'd still probably get it because I'm like, oh, variegated.
Because it looks cool. Yeah. Okay. So the answer is kind of like, you can't really tell, but it's an interesting tip for you to like use separate watering trays and maybe keep them separate from plants that, you know, like if it was the mosaic virus, wouldn't be able to thrive with it.
Right, for sure. And I just wanted to hit on the nutrient deficiency because nutrient deficiencies do show up as a color difference, but it's usually more like yellowing of the leaves or like purpling of the leaves around the edges. Usually nutrient related coloration or loss of coloration or whatever, that's usually very predictable and goes away when you fertilize the plant. So if you fertilize the plant and it goes away, it was a nutritional deficiency that caused that. So like I know that if plants are phosphorus deficient, they appear purpley around the edges of their leaves. But as soon as you hit them with fertilizer, it goes away. So if your plants are well fertilized, you don't even have to worry about that. And for the most parts, when you're buying a plant, they typically tend to be well fertilized anyway. So I wouldn't particularly worry about nutritional deficiencies when buying a plant. So I just wanted to hit that.
Got it. Okay. So we've got tissue variation, coloration, pathological, and then what was the fourth form?
The last one was sort of more of a clarification on like the nuclear versus mitochondrial. It's the genetic component of variegation, how variegation happens genetically. So randomly, the chloroplast will mutate, the mitochondria will mutate, the chromoplasts will mutate, and they'll either make excess pigment or they'll shut off their pigmentation genes and they'll form what's called marbling. So if you can imagine in your mind, or if you know what a coleus looks like, it's a very like patterned. Every leaf is exactly the same. Like they're typically like green margins or green borders and like red or purple centers. That's your typical coleus. And each leaf is exactly the same as the other leaves. And you can plant seeds of coleus and they'll grow true to their form. They'll be pigmented in exactly the same way. If it's chloroplast generated variegation, it'll be random. It'll be like marbling, like in a marble pothos or in a variegated monstera. Usually those are chloroplast derived. And so depending on where they're derived will determine like how you can propagate it, how you should propagate it, and things like that. So if it's in the nuclear genome of the plant, like with coleus or pelargoniums or certain kinds of begonias, things like that, where each individual leaf is the same as the other leaves in terms of their patterns, that's typically a nuclear derived variegation, and that you can generally propagate by seeds. And you can also take cuttings, of course. But if it is like a marbling or a random variegation where each leaf has a different pattern, kind of like a fingerprint, it's typically plastid derived. And usually you can only propagate that by cuttings, divisions, very rarely by seed. And even at that point, only if the maternal unit has those variegations, it might pass that off to its seedlings. Typically, no, but sometimes it does happen because the maternal plant, the plant that makes the seed, if that's variegated, that may pass on a variegated chloroplast or two to its youngins.
Can I talk through this for a minute? Because I'm just wrapping my brain around it. So,
yeah, go ahead.
If a plant has the same variegation on every leaf, so it's like a repeat pattern, it's probably a nuclear variegation, meaning that its actual genes, like the plant's genes, are different. And so because of that, because the actual whole gene is different, you can propagate with seed or with cuttings. But if it's a random thumbprint style variegation, like a Monstera Thai constellation would be something that comes to mind where each leaf looks totally different, that's something that's variegated within like a chloroplast in the leaf, not the root of the plant, not the root, but like the nucleus of the plant. So you have to actually propagate that leaf. Like you have to grab that chloroplast, right? Is that right? Okay. Interesting. Okay, cool. So some examples of chloroplast would be like Thai constellation or like my variegated watermelon peperomia, where some of the leaves are variegated and some aren't. That would be another like chloroplast one.
That would be another chloroplast one. That's also, it's randomly induced. It's occasionally we call it, if it were a tree, we'd call it a sport, where one branch is different from all the other branches. Like that one is the mutant branch. And that's actually how we came up with certain cultivars of like apple trees and things. You'd get like a random sport of like, I think a golden apple is like a random sport of like a red apple, but don't quote me on that. I'm like half remembering that. So, but that's an example of, you know, and that's also like when you find a variegated sport, like growers, they'll find randomly like variegated sports on like ZZ plants or whatever, and they'll cultivate that. They'll try to cultivate that. And the thing about variegation is that most variegated plants, variegation typically hinders a plant because if you have that loss of chlorophyll, like in a marbling, and I'm more so talking about the marbling kind, because those cells are no longer generating energy for the plant, they're actually absorbing energy from the plants with more variegation tend to be more slow growing, and you need to give them more light actually if you want to help sustain their growth and sustain their variegation. So there's two theories right now as to how variegation happens randomly, or how that marbling variegation happens. And one is through excess light. If you blast a plant with excess light, it may become variegated at some point. And there's a small grain of truth to that, although the probability is astronomically small. You are more likely to win the lottery than you are to force a plant to variegate by giving it excess light. The other way is through, and the grain of truth to excess light is that light is a form of radiation. All forms of light are a form of electromagnetic radiation. Radiation, you know, if you blast a plant with enough of it, it might mess up a gene. And again, you have to get lucky. Like it may mess up a different gene and you'll never know, but it could also mess up a pigmentation gene, in which case then you get a kind of variegation. But even then, it has to mess up a gene. in the actively growing part of the plant. So like you have to have all the stars aligned for that to happen. And not saying it doesn't happen ever, but it happens very, 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 very rarely. So that's one way. The other way is through a combination of heat and light, because heat causes oxidative stress on plants. And so you're probably like, what's that? Oxidative stress is when you have some sort of like chemical or energy that's trying to mess up the equilibrium of your cells, and you secrete a bunch of antioxidants. That's where antioxidants come in. They prevent oxidation or chemical free radicals going. So free radical is just an electron that doesn't have any place to go, and it starts messing stuff up, like ripping apart compounds, which is why free radicals are dangerous. But plants produce antioxidants in order to combat that. And there's, you know, not to get too off topic, but I did want to mention that like the plants that are like so-called high in antioxidants, like coffee, like green bean coffee or like green tea or whatever. Yeah, they're high in antioxidants, but they're also high in poisons that induce free radicals. So like they actually make antioxidants to counter their own poisons. So people should be aware of that rather than be like, oh, you know, coffee has so many antioxidants, it's so good for you. It's like, well, it's poisoning you too. So, but anyway, getting back to variegation, excess light and excess heat, or if you want to do it the way that they do it in laboratories, like in tissue culture, all you have to do is blast it with a little bit of ultraviolet. Some places are pretty wacky. They blast plants with x-rays, which I'm like, ooh, that's like using like too much. It's like using like a nuclear bomb to kill an anthill. Like it's way too much. Yeah, I mean, you can induce variegation that way, but variegation when it first occurs is generally what we call not stable and not fixed. When the variegation's not stable, it's, you know, when you first induce it like they do in like Thailand and all these other places where they're trying to like make these plants to sell to people because they fetch such a pretty penny. When you first mutate it, it hasn't quite sunken in or it hasn't quite fixed itself yet, because variegation is something that the plant does try to fight. And if the plant is sort of aware of it, and again, this is where we need more studies, because we know that the plant knows when it's variegated. We know that the plant knows that variegation is something wacky. And a lot of times the plant will either trend towards becoming completely variegated and dying, where the mutation takes over, or plant will trend towards just reverting and going back to being green again. So the plant wants to become green again because it's like, I want my leaves to be as productive as possible. Unless it's like, of course, like a pre-programmed, like I am pigmented like this, like a coleus or like an oxalis, I'm supposed to be this way, that's fine. Or unless it's nuclearly encoded, for example, in like the dual tissue with like the shiny begonias and the shiny jewel orchids as well.
Thank you, Espoma Organics, for supporting today's episode. Plant friends, you all know that I love using Espoma Organics potting mix, plant food, and horticultural sprays on my plant babies. I have been using them for a while. So Espoma Organics is a family-owned and operated company dedicated to making safe indoor and outdoor gardening products for people, pets, and the planet. So when my plant collection started growing significantly in my early days, I decided that I wanted to get not only more intentional about what plants I was bringing home, but what I was actually potting my plants up in and what I was using to feed and care for my plants. And that's where Espoma Organics entered my life. So plant friends, I have so many plants in my apartment. I'm actually a little bit of a low maintenance plant parent where I need easy, high quality solutions for my daily and monthly and weekly plant care routine. So I love the Espoma Organics Easy Dose Liquid Indoor Houseplant plant food because they make the measuring and dosing so easy. The cap is actually the pre-measured dose amount. So you just flip the bottle over with the cap closed, the cap pre-fills, and then you just dump that cap into your watering can. No muss, no fuss. They make it so easy. And their potting mix, they have already done the work of making sure that all of the high quality stuff is in the potting mix. So I'm not worried about having to like mix a whole bunch of stuff together. I just am able to use their potting mix. And now we are actually using their horticultural sprays on a monthly basis to spray down our plants for a preventative measure, which we're really finding a lot of success with. And if you are an outdoor gardener as well, they have a ton of amazing outdoor products for you, like their Plantone, which is an all-natural, all-purpose plant food and long-lasting fertilizer for flowers, veggies, trees, and shrubs. Espoma has something for everyone. So if you want to learn more about their organic indoor and outdoor solutions for plant people around the country, you can visit espoma.com to see where your local Espoma dealers are, or you can click the link in the show notes, which is a link to my Bloom & Grow Radio Amazon storefront where I show you all of my favorite Espoma products. All right, let's get back to the show. In nature, in the jungle, when this variegation happens, it's completely random. Like, why does it happen in nature, I guess, before we focus on how to make it happen in our urban jungles, you know? It is just like a random genetic mutation.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a couple of theories flying around but as to why plants variegate in nature. And it ranges from, oh, it's just a fluke and doesn't mean anything, which is very possible. Like, we as humans try to find and ascribe meaning. Sometimes there is no meaning. Sometimes it just is. So it may very well be that variegation just is. But there's another theory that says that variegation makes, so insects have very poor vision. And some scientists think that, and I kind of ascribe to this, like I kind of ascribe a little column A, a little column B. Scientists think that when a plant variegates, because insects have very poor vision, they think that that like marbling, for example, is, you know, oh, it's a leaf that's already been eaten and I don't want to eat that because there's no juicy green leaf left. So they kind of leave it alone. So we think that it's kind of like an anti-herbivory kind of thing, like, oh no, don't come after me. I'm already like dead and eaten, like that kind of stuff.
Because to me, what confuses me is variegation is like the lack of chloroplast. So isn't it harder for plants to photosynthesize when they have those white leaves or those patches of white on a leaf?
Exactly. So it is somewhat, not very, but somewhat detrimental to the plant in that it slows it down. It can't grow. It has all these cells that it has to support that don't contribute to it. But on the other hand, if that second theory is true that, oh, it does protect against herbivory, then that may be the advantage that is provided that like, oh, for the amount. So even though plants that are fully green have extra energy, they have to like keep regenerating leaves because they keep getting eaten versus the variegated plant, you know, doesn't have really as many eaten leaves, but it's slower because of the variegation. So that may very well be too. It still could be, it just is random and just is.
So then my next question would be, so we know that, you know, there's a variety of reasons for why this is going to happen in nature, but the variegation does affect the plant. So if we as plant parents are bringing home a variegated plant, what do we need to know in terms of care and how that plant is going to differ from our other houseplants? Do we need to water differently? Do we need to give it a different amount of light because it does have those white patches where it isn't photosynthesizing? Like, what do we need to know to help the plants thrive?
Yeah, perfect. So the first thing I think with variegation, like with any plant, is always buy from a reputable vendor. I stress this. I'm like, spend the extra dollar or two to get a good quality plant from a place that you trust. 9,000 times out of 10, you will have a much better plant to begin with. And when you start off on a good foot, you're going to end off on a good foot. And you're going to have a great plant for all of your parents. So get from vendors that have like established variegation. They have good practices. I know a lot of people try to order plants from like overseas to try to get the rare stuff, but it's like, you may be getting a plant that was like blasted 5 minutes ago. And yeah, these first couple of leaves are variegated, but then it loses its variegation because it got hurt during shipping or, you know, it just isn't fixed. And it wasn't a high quality grower that knew what they were doing. So that's part one. Part two, when you get a variegated plant, you bring it home, because they don't have as many chloroplasts, you want to give them more light than you would a normal version of it. So for example, if I have a variegated Monstera versus a regular Monstera, I would put the variegated Monstera much closer to the window, even some direct sun. I do give all of my variegated plants some direct sun, including my jewel orchids, which might surprise some people. I've had some jewel orchids that I kept them in sort of like the medium-ish light conditions, like no direct sun, bright indirect light, north-facing window. And like they did okay there, but they didn't really start exploding until I gave them more light, which makes sense because more light, more food, more growth. So definitely more light for variegated plants. Watering, it remains the same. The watering structure hasn't changed. Most other things about the plant haven't changed. It's just more of a light issue. Give them more light and they will reward you more and they will grow faster.
And obviously, these fancy scientists are doing all sorts of fancy stuff in labs to encourage variegation. We can't do that. But if we bring a variegated plant home, is there a way that we can perpetuate it staying variegated or encourage more variegated leaves?
That's the million-dollar question, right? So again, if it's a marbling, it's completely random and it's whatever the plant decides. The only thing you can really do, and I wish there were more we can do, but the only thing you can do is if you have a plant, it'll go either one or two ways. Like I have a variegated Monstera and one part of the plant is starting to trend to going completely white. Another part of the plant is starting to trend to go completely green. And in fact, I have one entirely green growth coming off of the plant. Now, you can go about this many ways. Some people like to have a certain level of variegation, like I want 50-50 green-white, and they try to trim the plant of anything that's not 50-50 green-white, and that's fine. You can do that. It comes down to really trimming and pruning. Like I leave the reversions or the green reversions on the plant up to a certain extent. Like I'll only allow, so my variegated Monstera has like a small offshooting that's completely green again, but I don't let it get too long, but I still let it live. And people are like, why would you do that? One, it looks weird, which well, I guess it kind of does, but I know that those leaves are fully green. I know that those leaves are going to be like 10, 20, 30 times more productive than the variegated leaves. So I'm basically leaving those green leaves on as like, let's collect extra energy and give it because it's part of the same plant. Exactly, like a generator to the variegated leaves. So my variegated Monstera actually grows much faster than other people's variegated Monstera, partly because it's huge now, but also because I leave one little sport and I don't let it get too big of green growth so that it can absorb that extra sunlight and feed the variegated leaves. Now, what I also do is when it becomes too variegated or I start getting plain white leaves, they're insta-popular, great, but like if you start getting pure white growth that is kind of destined to die. It is a complete leech off of the plant and it'll just keep growing until it actually exhausts the plant and the plant dies. So it'll keep going.
Because that entirely white leaf is doing nothing for the plant. It's not able to photosynthesize and it's still requiring the water and the nutrients that the plant is absorbing to like make food and sugars, right?
Mostly, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say the white does nothing because the variegated tissue does generate other like sunscreen-like compounds for the plant. So it is doing something for the plant. Like it's like a chemical factory. Like the plant needs a chemical, the variegated leaf will make it because the other leaves are busy with photosynthesis, but they don't produce any food. So at some point, if you keep expanding the hungry mouths, then eventually the whole plant starves to death. So I actually cut off any sort of growth that is 100% purely variegated or pure white in that case.
Okay. So some of my Patreon plant friend supporters sent in questions, and actually two of them have to do with this exact situation. So Daphne has a small variegated Hoya carnosa variegata, and she was saying that her plant isn't growing. It looks healthy, but it's not growing. So she was wondering if she should cut the white leaves to instigate growth. And Danielle has a Hoya Crimson Queen, and she was wondering if she should cut off the entirely white leaves because she's wondering if the white leaves would hurt the plant. So I guess for Danielle, she should cut the entirely white leaves off because that's what you do. And then for Daphne with the Hoya Crimson, it's just probably growing slower because it is variegated and it's photosynthesizing at a different rate.
Right. So I will say with like the white leaves, if the bud of the plant is throwing off white leaf after white leaf after white leaf, I cut the bud off. I should clarify. I cut the bud off so that it doesn't generate any more. Like you could leave a couple of, you know, pure white variegated leaves. That's perfectly fine. But I cut off the bud so it doesn't make any more. So
you cut the bud, meaning the like stem, not just the leaf.
The tip, yeah, the stem tip so that it doesn't continue growing along that, you know.
You get rid of that whole little section of the plant.
Exactly. But I like if there's a couple of white leaves on there, like I'll leave the white leaves on. I'll just cut the bud off so that it doesn't continue growing along that path. So it doesn't make any more white leaves to suck off the plant. But if there's like a couple completely white leaves, especially on a Hoya, they tend to be very tolerant of different kinds of variegation. And some plants are more tolerant, some plants are not. Hoya typically are more robust, even if they're variegated. So I would say leave it if there's a couple of white leaves. Now, with the other one, I think, what was Daphne's question again?
Daphne has a small variegated Hoya carnosa that isn't growing. So she's wondering if she should cut off the white leaves to instigate more growth.
I would actually increase light and fertilize before I start cutting variegated leaves off. Like, it's going to be slower because it's variegated. And yeah, you could spur some growth if you get rid of the variegated leaf, sure. But I think that if there's no growth at all, I think that it's sort of at that tipping point where, like, if it gets any less light, it will die off. If it gets any more light, it'll start growing. So I would increase light and fertilize, actually.
Okay. I have a couple more questions for you I'd love to ask. So what about reverting? Because reverting is when you get, you know, you invest in your variegated plant and you bring it home and it in the shop has two or three variegated beautiful leaves. And then you come home and it only is growing new green growth. So it's reverting back to its original all green version of itself. So is there a way to unrevert, I guess, your plant? So is there a way, if it starts to revert and only grow all green leaves, is there a way to get it to grow the variegated leaves again?
Right. So my answer to that is yes and no.
Okay.
It depends on how big that like particular plant or cutting is. I know a lot of cuttings are sold very, very small, very, very short. So there, you don't have a lot to work with. So if it does start reverting, I would, again, just for the sake of the plant's like own stability, I mean, first off, I would try to determine, okay, is this variegation like something that was induced? Is this plant leaf orange because it was getting way too much light and now it's not in as much light and it's turning green? Like, try to figure out, is that the cause? In which case, like, put it back in the light so that it, you know, goes back to being more orange. Like, for example, Philodendron Prince of Orange, and a lot of philodendrons that have pigmentation tend to be more highly pigmented with more light they receive. And that makes sense because more light, more energy, you can make more pigments. So that's number one. I would troubleshoot first, give it more light, see what happens. But if it does actually, like if there's like a solid pattern or marbling, and then there's like not marbling on the new growth, what I would do is I would leave a little piece of the reversion to stay green just so that it gives energy to the rest of the plant to grow. Exactly. And then like trim off the tip or the bud so that it can't really get too much bigger. And then hope that there's still a node where on the variegated part, where the variegated part can start to like self-generate. Like if there's a node or like a piece of the stem where the variegated piece can like sort of sprout a new branch, so to speak, then that's kind of what you're aiming for. But if it's just one variegated leaf or like a couple variegated leaves and like there's no node there or like it's damaged or whatever, and the rest of it's just green, it's probably just going to stay green. And that green part, the chances of that reverting back to an actual variegated plant are higher than if you took something that was always green and tried to variegate it, but still astronomically low. So I have low to no hopes for that. Sorry. Because I've never seen it revert back from green, although I've heard it's possible and it is like more likely than not. Sorry, I should say more likely than forever green plants to go back to being variegated. I've heard from some growers, but this is anecdotal. I don't know if it's true.
And what about Anna P., another one of our Patreon plant friends, wants to know, how would you suggest experimenting with different colors of variegation that aren't just white? Is there a certain color that you feel like is safer to try before others?
I mean, you can try whatever you want. I mean, they're just colors. So it's just a matter of how much light you have. If you like reds, go with reds and give them a bunch of light. If you like the marble, go with the marble, give it a bunch of light. It's not, unless she's referring to like toxicity, in which case that just goes back to whatever the plant is. Like pigmentation typically, anthocyanins typically aren't like that dangerous, and carotenoids typically aren't that dangerous. So I would say that you can start with whatever you like.
Is it a similar rule of thumb? Like, you know, with succulents, how like if a succulent is pink or purple or lighter color, it probably needs more light than like a darker green Haworthia or a darker green Echeveria. Is it similar with variegation that like the brighter the color or the brighter the pink, like the more light that variegated plant needs? Or it's pretty much more of a rule of thumb of if the plant is variegated, it needs more light than normal?
No, I think you really hit it right on the head right there. Yes, absolutely. The more robust the color is, the more light you want to give it to maintain that robustness.
And then with hyperpigmentation, like the Black Raven ZZ, just because that's like such a popular plant right now, because it's hyperpigmented, even though ZZ is like your classic low light plant, will the hyperpigmented ZZ still thrive in low light? Or because it's hyperpigmented and darker, you do need to actually put it in higher light?
I always shy away from the word thrive. It always like makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. I don't want to say thrive, but in lower lights, I have seen Black Raven ZZs go back to looking like a regular plain old ZZ plant. So while they are programmed to make extra pigment, they also need the light. And again, exactly. And I'm always like a big preacher of like, stop trying to make plants work away from a window. Unless you have a super hardcore grow light, and most super hardcore grow lights look absolutely hideous, so you're probably not going to do that. It's not going to work away from a window. Like, always put your plants in a window. More light is always better. If it loss of color means you're not getting enough light, whether it's green turning to lighter green in a lot of plants, or whether it's complete loss of pigmentation, like in the Raven ZZs, they'll start looking like regular ZZs if you put them in a dark corner.
Can a white leaf burn? Because another listener wrote in saying, how do I walk the line of giving it as much light as possible, but also not burning the white leaves and burning the white sides?
Yeah, they tend to be a little more sensitive to dryness, and they tend to be a little more sensitive, not that much, I shouldn't say that. They tend to be a little more sensitive to heat as well. They tend to, whatever it is, I still quite haven't figured it out myself, but they are more sensitive to, like, I think it's heat that they're sensitive to, and that they crisp out at the edges. Because even my white leaves on my variegated Monstera, in the dead of summer when it gets super hot in my living room, they just kind of like start to brown around the edges, and then like the weird fungi that are inside. Because sometimes when you have white variegation, you get like the endophytes or some of the fungi actually start to manifest themselves. Like you can see the brown, and this is just fungus that has always lived in the plant and like it's always been there. Like you can kind of like start to see them. Once it turns white, it's like a little weird, but like people are like, oh, what are these like weird brown, like coffee stains on my like white Monstera leaf? It's like, oh, those are the endophytic fungi doing their thing. So yeah, they can crisp out at the edges. I've had white Monstera leaves crisp out at the edges. I think it's heat. I'm not quite sure what that is, but I would say if you keep the plant in good conditions, if you keep it well-watered, well-fertilized, enough light, it shouldn't do that. But also, I'm a big also preacher of don't mist your plants unless it's an epiphyte. And then, of course, I'm going to get a whole bunch of hate mail about how, like, Monstera is an epiphyte. But don't mist your leaves, because sometimes it's fungally induced. Sometimes you get brown edges because it's a fungus. So, you know, it's not always just because it's variegated. It could be just as simple as, you know, principle of Occam's razor, the simplest explanation. Oh, it's a fungus. So don't mist your leaves.
PSA, don't mist your leaves, everyone. Okay, I love this. So if our plant friends in the community are interested in getting a variegated plant, what are your top five favorite variegated plants that don't cost us an arm and a leg that you feel like would be fun to maybe look into bringing home?
Absolutely. My top pick is going to be, just because they're just so easy to get a hold of, they're very rewarding, they're fast growers, are begonias. So the metallic-y kind of begonias. I'm getting Begonia pavlonina. There's other begonias as well, like hybrids, Rex begonias, typically they're metallic. My next pick would be, of course, because I'm, you know, love orchids. So I'm going to say jewel orchids, because a lot of jewel orchids have super interesting patterns. There's Goodyera, there's Ludicia, there's all the other ones. So begonias, jewel orchids. I do like marbling. Like I do like variegated Monstera. It's a fun, cool, like big leaf plant. So like any kind of variegated aroid is usually pretty easy. So whether it's a golden pothos or a variegated Monstera or anything else, that typically, you know, works for me. And then like other plants, as far as variegation, are usually kind of rare. Like a variegated fern is pretty rare. Typically variegation is pretty rare, with the exception of like pothos. Golden pothos are like everywhere. But like, I think those are good to start with. You can start with a pothos as well, as far as variegation, you can experiment. And Hoyas. Hoyas are really good to start with. So begonias, jewel orchids, Hoyas, and some variegated aroids. But if you already have the aroids that are variegated, I'm sort of a fan of, if you have one kind of like class of plants, experiment with another. Like if you have an aroid, like a pothos or Monstera or ZZ plant, like experiment with a begonia, or experiment with like some other kind of plant, just to see like how it works. Because you may be surprised. You may find like, oh my goodness, this thing works so well in my house and I would have never tried it otherwise. So,
you know what just tickles me so much? And it's such a readily available plant. It's so easy to find. But I will sit and look at it. I am like in awe of every leaf that unfurls in these plants that we have. And I know it's its own thing because it's like patented or something, but Philodendron Brazil, that's a variegated plant.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because of the yellow stripe. The way that the yellow stripe kind of manifests in each leaf a little bit differently is it's in my green wall on my wall. And like every leaf, Billy and I just sit there and like look at the different kind of manifestation of the three different colors of like yellow and green in it. And it's really easy to get. And I just feel like it's such a beautiful plant that gets overlooked a lot because it's like not rare, you know? So that's, I feel like another one that, and it grows so well, like it grows so fast. It's like completely taken over our green wall. And it's just so, it's such an easy care plant as well. Like if someone wants just like a really low maintenance, like entry option for something.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I just love that plant.
It's a great plant. And it, just like you said, it's a quick grower. It's pretty rewarding and it's variegated. So it's pretty cool.
And it's just beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so thankful for this conversation. I feel like I could talk to you about variegation for 2 hours. But another thing I've kind of been musing on to myself lately is variegation versus variation. And just knowing that the light in my home is different than the light in your home is different than the light in everyone else's home. We have listeners around the world in different parts of, you know, the world with different setups. And what about just the variation in environment that we have? Like, what are some final thoughts on that?
So variation is different from variegation. They sound similar, but they're different. A variation or a variety of a plant is, you know, just a plant that grows sustainably in a different way. So like, for example, and it depends on how you define it, because a variety is what we would call below a species level. And scientifically, we kind of don't pay attention. Like once you hit species, anything below that, we typically don't really care about. Or it's like very nitpicky, like, oh, it's this variety versus like this, you know, cultivar versus whatever. Unless it's a registered cultivar, we typically don't care, sorry. But like a variety is just like, based on your growing conditions, you can have plants grow in different ways. Like, for example, someone will think, oh, you know, my syngonium or whatever is growing really long and spindly. That may be because you're not getting as much light, or it may be more pale green and less bushy than a syngonium that has been getting, you know, some sun. And that one's darker green and that one's, you know, more bushy, even though they may be cuttings from the same plant. So environment does have an influence definitely on morphology, which is why whenever someone comes to me with like a plant ID with like, oh, well, this Monstera's leaf is slightly more pointy than that one. It must be a different species. And it kind of looks like this. I'm like, first off, no. Second off, you know, we need flowers to determine whether or not it's another species. It's not just morphology, because morphology is and can be influenced by environment. So that's why we don't always go off of just, oh, this plant is shaped differently. It must be a different species. So varieties are, I mean, it's kind of like saying, what is a species? It's a hard question to completely define, but it's like a variety is a different version. Think of it as like a different version of the same thing. Like I can have like red bubble gum or green bubble gum or whatever. Like there's white flowers. This one has white flowers. That one has purple flowers. That's the purple flowered variety, we would say in the gardening world. And some people may think it's a different species based on its geography. Like, oh, all the purple ones come from Europe and the white ones come from North America. I don't know. I'm just kind of making this up as I go along. But like that would be the example to justify those two as separate species. Even though they are kind of varieties of one another, they can completely crossbreed, so on and so forth. So varieties are just different versions of the same thing. It's nothing too specific. Some varieties are patented and we call them cultivated varieties or cultivars. Those are like, for example, ZZ Black Raven. They bred a ZZ to overexpress or overproduce pigment. And that variety of ZZ is a black ZZ. Like I would look at it and say, oh, that's the black variety of a ZZ plant. But they happen to cultivate it, patent it, and now it's ZZ Black Raven. So now it is a cultivar, which stands for cultivated variety.
Got it. But
I know that was a lot.
No, that I'm like, yes, I agree. Right. Exactly. Yeah. But I think like, yeah, it's interesting and important as like moving forward to just understand, like, there are so many varieties, there are so many variegations, and also like plants are just going to grow differently in all of our environments. So no two plants are alike. And that's why we like plants so much, because they're all beautiful little unique snowflakes.
They are, and we love them all the better for them.
Exactly. So if you guys end up bringing home variegated plants, tag me and Chris. We'd love to see your variegated plant babies and how you're caring for them. Chris, thank you so much for your time. You are so awesome. I can't wait to have you back on for another chat sometime soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And I guess your listeners can hit me up on Instagram too. I'm more than happy to answer questions there as well.
Yes. Where can we find you these days?
You can find me at Botanic Tonic on Instagram. You can also find me on the web. I'm at ChristopherSatch.com. So
ChristopherSatch.com. And the links will be in the show notes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris, for this unbelievable episode. Man, I really feel like he just illuminated so many things. I thought our conversation about variegation versus variation was so interesting. I'm really looking at variegated plants very differently after this conversation. And this is another thing, plant friends, I think since I've been away from my plants now for 10, going on 11 months, I've been looking at plant care from a much more like zoomed out perspective. And it's causing me to ask questions like, why is a plant variegated? Not just like being obsessed about getting the next variegated plant, if you know what I mean. And what makes up soil and what makes a good soil? And, you know, thinking about these aspects of plant care and aspects of collecting plants in a much wider kind of zoomed out way. And I feel like this episode was just so enlightening. And I'm going to look at nature differently. And I'm going to look at my variegated collection of plants very differently. So I'm so thankful to Chris. So if you want to go follow him, go check him out at Botanic Tonic on Instagram. His website is also linked in the show notes. If you have questions for him, check out that Manhattan Orchid Society show in January. Everything is linked into the show notes. My plant friends, my Patreon plant friends, thank you, thank you, thank you for supporting the show. Thank you to today's episode sponsors, Modern Sprout. If you are interested in finding out more about Modern Sprout's amazing lines of grow lights, adorable and innovative hydroponic grow kits, and great plant accessories, visit modernsprout.com and use the code BLOOM15 at checkout for 15% off. And if you are looking to upgrade your potting mix, if you are looking to upgrade your fertilizers, your food, your pest control sprays, if you're looking to go organic, look no further than Espoma Organics. Check out espoma.com to find your local Espoma dealer, or you can click the link in the show notes to my Amazon storefront where I show you all of the favorite Espoma products that I am using these days. My sweet plant friends, thanks for listening, and until next time, keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, thank you so much for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure you are subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're making sure you're subscribed, why don't you head on over to the review section of whatever podcast player you're tuning into and leave us a review. I would greatly appreciate it. If you are interested in more fun and educational planty content, well, plant friend, I've got a whole lot for you. Subscribe to the Bloom and Grow YouTube show, which is my YouTube channel where I bring you along for my personal plant journey, as well as share informational content that pairs with our podcast episodes. Follow me at Bloom and Grow Radio on Instagram for behind-the-scenes sneak peeks at upcoming episodes, my daily planty lessons and thoughts, and most importantly, tune into my Instagram stories where I am constantly talking with you listeners and plant friends and polling you for content ideas, and I'm always interested in seeing what you're loving these days on Instagram. Join the Bloom and Grow mailing list and get a free download of the Molly Mansfield Keep Blooming print that she created exclusively for our community. And if you can, support Bloom and Grow Radio by becoming a plant friend on Patreon. For as little as $4 a month, you not only help me bring these planty and informative episodes to thousands of ears around the world, but you will also get the super secret planty password to our exclusive Bloom and Grow Radio Garden Club Facebook group, which is a wonderfully active group of plant friends of the Bloom and Grow Radio podcast who make up what I like to call the plantiest corner of the internet. It is a lot of fun over there. And as always, my sweet plant friends, I am here for you. If you have ideas for episode topics, guests, or if you're possibly a business interested in sponsoring the show, reach out to me because I am here to help all of you keep blooming and keep growing.